proper wedding, with parents, siblings, aunts and uncles by their sides. They'd have danced to Popwovsky, sipped champagne from tall flutes, and gorged on gingerbread cake. The night, no doubt, would have wrapped with Addie, Halina, and Mila taking turns at the keys of a piano, serenading their guests with a jazz tune, a Chopin nocturne. He glances at Bella. They'd agreed it was the right thing, to marry here in Lvov, and even though she never said it, he knows she must feel a similar longing for the wedding they thought they'd have, the wedding she deserved. Let it go, Jakob tells himself, pushing aside the familiar stitch of regret. Around the table, glasses touch rims, their cylindrical bottoms catching the candlelight as bride and groom and guests sip their beer. Bella coughs and covers her mouth, her eyebrows arched, and Jakob laughs. It's been months since they've had a drink, and the ale is harsh. Potent, Genick offers, his dimples carving shadows in his cheeks. We'll all be drunk before we know it. I think I might already be drunk, Anna chimes in from the far end of the table. As the others laugh, Jakob turns, rests his hand on Bella's knee beneath the table. Your ring is waiting for you in Radom, he whispers. I'm sorry I didn't give it to you sooner. I was waiting for the perfect moment. Bella shakes her head. Please, she says, I don't need the ring. I know this isn't... Shush, Jakob, Bella whispers. I know what you're going to say. I'm going to make it up to you, love, I promise. Don't, Bella smiles. Honestly, it's perfect. Jakob's heart swells. He leans closer, his lips brushing her ear. It's not how we imagined it, but I want you to know, I've never been happier than I am right now, he whispers. Bella is blushing again. Me either. Chapter 10, Nehuma. Radom, German-occupied Poland, October 27, 1939. Nehuma has stockpiled the family's valuables and laid them out into neat rows across the dining room table. Together, she and Mila take inventory. We should bring as much as we can, Mila says. Yes, Nehuma agrees. I'll leave a few things as well with Liliana. Nehuma's boys grew up playing kapela in the building's courtyard with Liliana's children. The Kurtzes and the Sobchaks are close. I can't believe we're leaving, Mila whispers. Nehuma rests her hands on the carved mahogany back of a dining chair. No one has actually said the words yet, not out loud at least. I can't either. A pair of Wehrmacht soldiers had rapped on their door early that morning with the news. You have until the end of the day to collect your personal belongings and get out, one of them said, thrusting a slip of paper in Saul's direction with a new address stamped across the top. You will return to work tomorrow. Nehuma had glared at the man from beside her husband, and he'd glared back, looking at her with his face pinched, as if he'd ingested something rotten. The furniture stays, he added before turning to leave. Nehuma had thrown a fist in the air and whispered a string of profanities once the door was closed, then huffed down the hall to the kitchen to wrap a cold cloth around her neck. The soldier's visit was no surprise, of course. Nehuma had sensed it was only a matter of time before the Nazis came around. There was an influx of Germans in Radom. They needed homes, and the Kurtz's five-bedroom apartment was spacious, their street one of Radom's most desirable. When two Jewish families in the building were evicted the week before, she and Saul had begun to prepare. They'd counted and polished their silver, tucked a few bolts of fabric behind a false wall in the living room, even contacted the committee that allocated new addresses for evicted Jews in order to request a space that was clean and large enough to fit them all, Halina, Mila, and Felicia included. Still, nothing could truly prepare Nehuma for how it would feel to leave her home of over 30 years at 14 Borshavska. Let's pack quickly and get it over with, she declared once she'd calmed. While Nehuma and Mila arranged their most precious possessions into piles, Saul and Halina made trips back and forth to their assigned two-bedroom flat on Lubelska Street, in the old quarter, lugging copper pots and bedside lamps, a Persian rug, a favorite oil on canvas purchased years ago in Paris, a sack full of linens, a sewing kit, a small tin of kitchen spices. With no indication as to when they'd be able to return to their home, they stuffed their suitcases full of clothes for all seasons. By noon, Saul declared the flat nearly full. "Once we bring the valuables," he said, "we won't have room for much else." It came as no shock, but still, Nehuma's heart dropped. She knew that the bathtub, her writing table, and the piano would have to stay, as would the antique vanity bench that she'd upholstered in French silk brocade. The brass headboard with its beautiful scalloped castings and rounded posts, a surprise gift from Saul on their 10th anniversary, the mirrored china cabinet that once belonged to her great-grandmother, the wrought iron basket on the balcony that she filled each spring with geraniums and crocuses. She would miss them too. But how could they leave behind the portrait of Saul's father, Gershon, that hung in the living room? The indigo tablecloths and ivory statuettes she collected over the years from her travels. The crystal serving bowl filled with blown glass grapes that she'd placed on the parlor windowsill to catch the morning light. The afternoon had slipped away as Nehuma wandered around the apartment, running her fingers along the spines of her favorite books and picking through boxes of drawings and assignments she'd saved from her children's school days. Though they wouldn't do them any good in the new flat, these were the things that mattered, Nehuma realized as she turned them over in her hands. These were the things that defined them. In the end, she allowed herself one suitcase of keepsakes with which she simply couldn't part, a collection of Chopin waltzes for the pianoforte, a stack of family photos, a book of Peretz's poetry. She packed the sheet music for a piece Addie learned when he was 5, a Brahms lullaby, with his piano teacher's note scrawled in the margin, "Very good, Addie. Keep up the hard work." A gold-plated picture frame engraved with the year 1911, and inside, a photo of Mila, bald and big-eyed, no bigger than Felicia is now. The tiny red leather shoes that were laced first to Genek's, then Addie's, then Jakob's feet when they took their first steps. The faded pink hair clip Halina had insisted on wearing every day for years. The rest of her children's things she placed carefully in boxes, which she then pushed to the very back of her deepest closet, praying she would return to them soon. Now, at the dining room table, Nehuma sets a silver bowl and ladle aside for the sobchaks. The rest, she decides, will come with them. "Let's start with the porcelain," she says. She lifts the teacup from the table, gold-trimmed, with delicate pink peonies painted beneath its rim. They wrap the cups and saucers individually in linen napkins, nestle them into a box, then move on to the silver, two sets, one passed down from Saul's mother, the other from Nehuma's. "These I thought I'd cover with fabric and sew onto a shirt to look like buttons," Nehuma says, pointing to the two gold coins she'd set atop a substantial pile of zloty bills, the fraction of their savings they were able to withdraw before their bank accounts were frozen. "Good idea," Mila says. She picks up a sterling hand mirror and peers at her reflection for a moment, wrinkling her nose at the sight of the dark circles under her eyes. "This was your mother's, yes?" she asks. "It was." Mila sets the mirror gently into the box, folding a few meters of ivory Italian silk and white French lace into squares on top of it. Nehuma stacks the zloty and rolls them, along with the gold coins, into a napkin, which she slips into her purse. The table is bare now, save for a small black velvet pouch. Mila picks it up. "What's this?" she asks. "It's heavy." Nehuma smiles. "Here," she says, "I'll show you." Mila hands her the pouch, and Nehuma loosens the string, cinching the top of it closed. Open your hand, she says, emptying its contents into Mila's palm. Oh, Mila breathes. Oh my. Nehuma peers down at the necklace glittering in her daughter's palm. It's an amethyst, she whispers. I found it a few years ago in Vienna. There was something about it I couldn't resist. Mila turns the purple stone over, her eyes wide, as it catches the light from the chandelier overhead. It's beautiful, she says. Isn't it? Why don't you ever wear it? Mila asks, holding it up to her own neckline, feeling the weight of the stone, the gold chain resting on her collarbone. I don't know. Seems a bit ostentatious. I always felt self-conscious wearing it. Nehuma recalls how, on the day she first saw the necklace, the idea of owning such an extravagance had made her knees weak. It was 1935. She'd been in Vienna on a buying trip and had spotted it in a jeweler's window on her walk back to the train station. She tried it on and decided on an uncharacteristic impulse that she should have it, wondering the instant she left the store whether she would regret her decision. It was an investment, she told herself, and besides, she'd earned it. The shop had been doing well for a number of years by then, and her children were for the most part independent, finishing their final years in university, making a living for themselves. It was exorbitant, yes, but she remembers thinking that it was also the first time in her life that she could easily justify a splurge. Nehuma starts at the sound of banging on the door. She's lost track of the time. The Wehrmacht soldiers must be back to escort them out. Mila drops the necklace quickly back into its pouch, and Nehuma tucks it into her shirt between her breasts. Can you see it? She asks. Mila shakes her head no. Stay here, Nehuma whispers. Don't take your eyes off of these, she adds, setting her purse atop the box of valuables at their feet. Mila nods. Nehuma turns and straightens her back, inhaling deeply, gathering her composure. At the door, she lifts her chin, almost imperceptibly, as she tells the Wehrmacht soldiers in rudimentary German that her husband and daughter will be home soon to help them carry the last of their things. We need another 15 minutes, she says coolly. One of the soldiers glances at his watch.
5 minuten, he snaps. Schnell!
Nehuma says nothing. She turns from the door, resisting the urge to spit on the officer's polished leather jackboots. With her fingers curled around the key to the apartment, she isn't yet ready to hand it over. She paths through her home one last time, stepping quickly into each room, scanning for something she might have forgotten to pack, forcing her eyes to jump over the things she decided earlier she couldn't bring. If she looks too long, she'll have second thoughts, and leaving them behind will be torture. In her bedroom, she adjusts the base of a lamp so it aligns with the front of her dresser and smooths a wrinkle from the bedsheet. She folds and refolds a linen towel in the powder room. She pulls at a curtain in Jakob's room so it's even with the other. She tidies as if she's expecting company. In the living room, which she's left for last, Nehuma lingers for an extra moment, staring at the space where her children had practiced for hours upon hours at the piano, where for so many years they'd gathered after meals with someone at the keys. Making her way to the instrument, she runs her hand along its polished lid. Slowly, soundlessly, she closes the fall over the keys. Turning, she takes in the room's oak-paneled walls, the desk by the window overlooking the courtyard where she loved, more than anything, to sit and write. The blue velvet couch with its matching club chairs, the marble mantel over the fireplace, the floor-to-ceiling shelves stacked with music. Chopin, Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Brahms, Schumann, Schubert. And with the works of their favorite Polish authors, Sienkiewicz, Jeromski, Rabinowicz, Peretz. Walking quietly to her writing table, Nehuma brushes a bit of dust from the satinwood surface, grateful that she'd remembered to pack her stationery and favorite fountain pen. Tomorrow, she will write to Addy in Toulouse, telling him of their circumstances, of their new address. Addy. The fact that he will be leaving Toulouse soon to join the army troubles Nahuma deeply. Already she's coped with the stress of two sons in the military. Genek and Jakob's duty, at least, was short. Poland had fallen quickly. France, on the other hand, is yet to join the war. If the French get involved, and it seems only a matter of time before they do, there is no telling how long the fighting will last. Addy could be in uniform for months, years. Nahuma shudders, praying that she's able to reach him before he leaves for Parthenay. She will need to write to Genek and Jakob and Lvov, too. Her sons will be furious to learn that the family has been evicted from their home. Nahuma looks up at the ceiling as her eyes fill with tears. It's just temporary, she tells herself. Exhaling, she glances at the portrait of her father-in-law. He stares down at her, his gaze austere, penetrating. She swallows, then nods respectfully. Watch over our home for us, will you? She whispers. She touches her fingers to her lips and then to the wall, and makes her way slowly toward the door. Chapter 11. Addy. Outside Poitiers, France. April 15th, 1940. Beneath the deep green spires of an endless row of cypress trees, a dozen pairs of leather soles crunch the dirt. The men have been walking since dawn. Soon it will be dusk. Addy has spent the past several hours listening to the synchronized rhythm of footfall behind him, ignoring the blisters on his feet, and thinking of Radom. 6 months have passed since he's heard from his mother. It was the end of October, just before he left Toulouse, when he received her last letter. She'd written to tell him that the family was safe, all but Selim, who had gone missing, that his brothers were still in Lvov, that Jakob and Bella were soon to be married. The shop has been closed. We've been put to work, Nahuma wrote, detailing their new assignments. There were curfews and rations, and the Germans were despicable. But all that mattered, Nahuma had insisted, was that they were in good health and, for the most part, accounted for. Before signing off, she said that two Jewish families in their building had been evicted and forced into tiny flats in the old quarter. I fear, she wrote, that we will be next. In his reply, Addy had begged his mother to let him know right away if she was forced to move, and to send addresses for Jakob and Genek, but he hadn't received a response before he left Toulouse. Now he's on the move, impossible to reach. A knot has formed in his chest, and as the days and weeks slip by, it tightens. He loathes the unease of feeling so far away, so helplessly removed from his family in Poland. Addy switches on his headlamp, willing himself to stay positive. It has become easy to think the worst. He mustn't fall into that trap. And so, rather than imagine his parents and sisters evicted from their home and slaving away in some kitchen or factory under the Wehrmacht's watch, he thinks of Radom, the old Radom, the one he remembers. He thinks of how springtime in his hometown has always been his favorite time of year, for it is the season of Seder dinners and of birthdays, his and Halina's. Spring is when the Radomka and Lyeshna rivers flanking the city run high, feeding the city's rye fields and orchards, and when the domes of the horse chestnuts bordering Warszawska Street begin to leaf, offering shade to patrons perusing the ground floor shops for leathers, soaps, and wristwatches. Spring is when the flower boxes adorning the balconies on Malczewskiego Street overflow with crimson-red poppies, a welcome reprieve after the long gray winters, when Kościuszki Park bustles with vendors selling pickled cucumbers, shredded beets, smoked cheese, and sour rye meal mash at the Thursday market, when the Kurtz's neighbor Anton invites the children in the building to see his hatchlings, which barely even look like birds, all tiny and dusted and cream-colored down, unable even to hold up their heads, When he was a boy, Addy loved watching as Anton's flock of doves would fly from his window up to the eaves of the building's steepled rooftop, where they'd coo softly, presiding for a few minutes over the courtyard, before returning through the window to the wooden crate their keeper had built for them. Addy smiles at the memories, but is jolted back to the present, the images vanishing as a sound filters into his consciousness, a rustle. He stiffens and halts, lifting his elbow to 90 degrees, palm forward, fingertips skyward. In an instant, the soldiers behind him freeze. Addy cocks his chin, listening. There it is again, the rustling, coming from a cluster of elder bushes at the base of a cypress a few meters ahead. He toggles his rifle safety to the off position. "Ready," he whispers in Polish, resting his index finger gently on the metal curve of his trigger and aiming its muzzle at the shrubbery. Behind him, the soft click of 12 safeties sliding off. The rustle continues. Addy contemplates shooting, but decides to wait. What if it's just a raccoon or a child? A year ago, he could count on the fingers of one hand the times he'd carried a gun. When Addy was growing up, his uncle occasionally invited him and his brothers to go pheasant hunting, and while Genek seemed to enjoy the sport, Addy and Jakob preferred to stay back, warm by the fire, finding the whole process of flushing a bird from its cover unappealing. Now, to think about the responsibility he assumes every time he points his rifle makes his head spin. He and his men train their barrels on the cluster of bushes and wait. After a minute, something small appears at the base of one of the bushes, triangular, black, and shiny. A moment later, a pair of lower branches part, and a hound dog emerges. He sniffs at the darkening sky, then glances nonchalantly over his shoulder at the men staring at him, at the 13 muzzles aimed in his direction. Addy exhales, grateful he hadn't been quick to shoot. He lowers his rifle. "You scared us there, Capitan," he offers. But the hound, uninterested, turns and trots along the road headed east. "We have a new guide," Cyrus jokes from the rear. "Captain Paz," a murmur of laughter. "Let's go," Addy calls. Safeties are reset, and the men march on, the air around them filled again with the steady lilt of boots meeting the earth. Overhead, the cloud cover is thick. The air is cool and smells of rain. In another kilometer or two, Addy decides, they'll set up camp before they lose their light, before the rain comes. In the meantime, he lets his mind slip to Toulouse, thinking of how different his life is now from how it was 6 months ago. Addy had reluctantly left his apartment on Rue de Remusat on the 5th of November and reported for duty in Parthenay with the 2nd Polish Rifle Division of the French Army, the 2DSB, on the 6th, as he was ordered. After 8 weeks of basic training, he was awarded an official uniform of the French Army and assigned, thanks to his engineering degree and to his fluency in both French and Polish, the rank of Sergent de Carrière, which put him in charge of 12 sous-officiers. Addy enjoyed the company of the others in the 2DSB, surrounding himself with a group of young Poles, filled with a tiny bit of the void that had consumed him since being denied the right to return home. But that was about all he found comforting about the army. While he did his best to mask it, his rifle felt awkward in his hands, and when his captain barked orders in his direction, his instinct was to laugh. During drills, he found himself composing music in his head to distract himself from the monotony of wind sprints and target practice. Despite his distaste for the military, though, he found the days passed more enjoyably if he embraced the routine. After a while, he wore his double chevron stripes with a modicum of pride, and discovered that he was actually quite good at leading his small squad. Good, at least, at the logistics of it all. At getting his men from point A to point B, and in the meantime, discovering their strengths and delegating jobs. When they were on the move, for example, Bartek started the fires each night at camp. Pavlo cooked. Novitsky climbed the tallest tree in the vicinity to confirm that the lookout was clear. Sloboda schooled his men on how to safely pull the pin on the WZ-33 grenades they carried on their belts and on what to do should a bullet get stuck in the barrel of their Berthiers in a squib load malfunction. And Cyrus, the best of the lot if Addie had to choose, called out marching songs to kill time. Thus far, the favorites were Marsz Pierwszej Brigady and, of course, Poland's most patriotic anthem, Böże Coś Polskie. A couple of days ago, Addie's platoon, among the others of 2 DSP, was ordered to march 50 kilometers east of Poitiers. Addie guesses they've about 20 more kilometers to cover. From Poitiers, they'll continue some 700 kilometers farther by military convoy to Belfort, on the Swiss border. And from Belfort, they are to join up with the French 8th Army in Colombey-les-Belles, a city not far from the German border that lay on France's Maginot line of defense. Addie has never been to Poitiers, Belfort, or Colombey-les-Belles, but he studied them on the map. They're not close. Cyrus! Addie yells over his shoulder, in need of a distraction. A tune, please! From the back of the line comes a, yes, sir! And after a moment's pause, a whistle. At the sound of the first notes, Addie's ears perk up. He recognizes the tune immediately. The piece is called Liszt. It's his. The others recognize it too and join in, and the whistling becomes louder. Addie smiles. He hasn't told anyone about his dream of being a composer, or about the piece he wrote before the war, a big enough success, apparently, for his platoon to know it by heart. Perhaps it's a sign, Addie thinks. Perhaps hearing it now is an indication that it's only a matter of time before he reconnects with his family. It's a song about a letter, after all. The knot in Addie's chest loosens. He hums along with his men, scripting his next letter home as he marches. You won't believe, Mother, what I heard today in the field.
May 10, 1940. The Nazis invade the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. Despite Allied defenses, the Netherlands and Belgium surrender within the month. June 3, 1940. The Nazis bomb Paris. June 22, 1940. The French and German governments reach an armistice, dividing France into a free zone in the south under the puppet leadership of Marshal Pétain, based in Vichy, and a German-controlled occupied zone in the north and along the French Atlantic coast.
Chapter 12. Genek and Hertha. Lvov, Soviet-occupied Poland, June 28, 1940. The knock comes in the middle of the night. Genek's eyes snap open. He and Hertha sit up in bed, blinking into the darkness. Another knock, and then an order.
Otkroyte dveri!
Genek kicks himself free of the bedsheet and fumbles in the dark for the chain on his bedside lamp, squinting as his eyes adjust to the light. The air in the small room is hot, stagnant. With the blackout still in effect in Lvov, the curtains are permanently drawn. There is no such thing anymore as sleeping with the windows open. He runs the back of his hand across his forehead, wiping away a film of sweat. You don't think, Hertha whispers, but she's interrupted by more shouting.
Narodny komisariat vnutrennych dzieł!
The voice outside is loud enough to wake the neighbors. Genek curses. Hertha's eyes are wide. It's them, the secret police. They climb out of bed. In the 9 months since they settled in Lvov, Genek and Hertha have heard stories of these raids in the middle of the night, of men, women, and children snatched from their homes for money falsely owed, for being perceived resistors, for simply being Polish. Neighbors of the accused said they heard the knocks, the footsteps, a dog barking. And then in the morning, nothing. The homes were empty. The people, whole families, vanished. Where they were taken, no one knew.
We'd better answer it, Genek says,
convincing himself that he has nothing to fear. What could the secret police have on him? He's done no wrong. He clears his throat. Coming, he calls, reaching for a robe, and at the last minute, his wallet from the dresser. He slips it into his robe pocket. Herta wraps her own robe around her nightgown and follows him down the hallway. The moment Genek unlocks the door, a gang of rifle-wielding soldiers explodes into the apartment, forming a semicircle around them. Genek feels Herta's elbow loop around his as he counts the hammer and sickle patches, the blue and maroon peaked caps. There are 8 men in total. Why so many? He stares hard at the intruders, his fingers curled into fists, the hair on the back of his neck electric. The soldiers eye him with locked jaws until one finally steps forward. Genek sizes him up. He's short, with a squat wrestler's build and an obvious swagger, the one in charge. A small red star over his visor bobs up and down as he nods to his men, who turn obediently on their heels and file past them, down the hallway. Wait, Genek protests, scowling at the backs of their tunics. What right do you... He nearly says cockroaches, but catches himself. What right do you have to search my home? He can feel blood begin to throb in his temples. The officer in charge extracts a sheet of paper from a breast pocket. He unfolds it carefully and reads.
Gerzan Kulk? I am Gershon. We have warrant to search flat.
The officer's Polish is broken, his accent as thick as his midline. He waves the paper in Genek's face for an instant, as if to prove its credibility, then refolds it, returning it to his pocket. Genek can hear the havoc being wreaked in the adjacent rooms, drawers pulled from a dresser, furniture slid across the hardwood floor, papers scattered.
A warrant?
Genek narrows his eyes.
On what grounds?
He glances at the officer's rifle hanging by his side. He had been shown photos of Soviet carbines in the army, but Genek has yet to see one up close. This one looks like an M38, or perhaps an M9130. He knows where to look for the safety. It's off.
What the hell is going on?
The officer ignores the question.
Wait here,
he says, tucking his fingers into his Sam Brown belt as he strides down the hall, casually, as if the place were his own. Left alone in the foyer, Herta frees her elbow from Genek's and wraps her arms around her chest, flinching at the sound of something heavy colliding with the floor.
Bastards, Genek whispers under his breath. Who do they think?
Herta meets his eye.
Don't let them hear you, she whispers.
Genek bites his tongue, breathing heavily through flared nostrils. It's nearly impossible for him to keep quiet. He paces with his hands on his hips. The lawyer in him screams to demand to see the warrant. It can't be real, but something tells him it will do no good. After a few minutes, the flock of uniformed men assembles again at the door. They stand with their feet planted at shoulder width, their chests puffed up like roosters, still gripping their weapons. The one in charge points to Genek.
We take you for interrogation, Kurk,
he says.
Why?
Genek asks through his teeth.
I've done nothing wrong.
Just some questions.
Genek glowers down at the Russian, relishing the fact that he is a full head taller, that the officer must look up to make eye contact. And then I'll be free to come home?
Yes.
Herta steps forward.
I'm coming with you, she says.
It is a statement, her tone definitive. Genek looks at her, contemplates an argument, but she's right. It's better if she comes. What if the NKVD return?
She comes with me, Genek says.
Fine.
We need to dress, Herta says. The officer looks at his watch and then prongs his middle fingers.
You have 3 minutes.
In the bedroom, Genek steps into trousers and a button-down shirt. Herta zips herself into a skirt and then reaches under the bed for her suitcase. Just in case, she says. Who knows when we'll be back? Genek nods and retrieves his own suitcase. As much as he is reluctant to admit it, Herta may be right to assume the worst. He packs some undergarments, his good-as-new army-issued boots, a photograph of his parents, a pocket knife, his tortoiseshell comb, a deck of cards, his address book. He reaches for his robe, tucks his wallet into his trouser pocket. Herta packs a small pile of hosiery, undergarments, a hairbrush, 2 pairs of slacks, a wool tunic. At the last minute, they decide to bring their winter coats, then hurry down the hallway to the kitchen to collect what's left of a loaf of bread, an apple, and some salted fish from the pantry. My pocketbook, Herta whispers. I nearly forgot. She ducks back into the bedroom. Genek follows, frowning as he remembers that his own wallet is nearly empty.
Let's go,
the officer barks from the foyer. Find it? Genek asks. But Herta doesn't answer. She stands at the closet door, hands at her head, auburn hair spilling through her fingers. It's gone, she whispers. Genek brings a fist to his mouth to keep from cursing. What was in it? My ID, some money, a lot of money. Herta touches her left wrist. My watch is gone, too. It was on my bedside table, I think.
Maggots, Genek whispers.
The officer yells again, and Genek and Herta make their way silently back to the foyer. 20 minutes later, they sit at a small desk across from an officer clad in the same royal blue and maroon peaked cap worn by the men who had brought them in. The room is bare, save for a portrait of Joseph Stalin, suspended on the wall behind the desk. Genek can feel the general secretary's thick-browed eyes bearing down on him like a vulture's, and fights the urge to rip the photo from the wall and shred it.
You say you are Polish!
The officer opposite them makes no attempt to mask the disgust in his voice. He squints at a piece of paper in his hands. Genek wonders whether it's the so-called warrant. Yes, I'm Polish.
Where were you born?
I was born in Radom, 350 kilometers from here. The officer sets the paper on the table, and Genek immediately recognizes the handwriting as his own. The paper, he realizes, is a form, a questionnaire he was made to complete upon signing a lease with a manager of his apartment on Jelona Street, shortly after the Soviets took control of Lvov in September. The agreement was written on Soviet letterhead. Genek had thought little of it at the time.
Your family is still in Radom?
Yes.
Poland surrendered 9 months ago. Why haven't you returned?
I found a job here, Genek says, although it's only half true. In all honesty, he is reluctant to return home. His mother's letters painted an awful picture of Radom, of the armbands the Jews were forced to wear at all times, of the city-wide curfew, the 12-hour workdays, the laws banning her from using the sidewalks, from going to the cinema, from walking to the post office without special permission. Nehuma wrote about how they, like thousands of others living in the city center, had been evicted from their home and made to pay rent for a space a fraction of the size in the old quarter. How are we to afford rent when they've taken away our business, confiscated our savings, and put us to work like slaves for next to nothing, she fumed. She had urged him to stay. You're better off in Lvov, she wrote.
What kind of job?
I work for a law firm. The officer eyes him suspiciously.
You're a Jew. Jews aren't fit to be lawyers.
The words sizzle like drops of water on a hot pan. I'm an assistant at the firm, Genek says. The officer leans forward in his wooden chair, resting his elbows on the desk.
You understand, Kurk, that you are now on Soviet soil?
Genick parts his lips, tempted to unleash.
No, sir, you are wrong. You are on Polish soil.
But he thinks better of it, and it's in this moment that he understands the reason for his arrest. The questionnaire, he recalls, had a box he was meant to check in order to accept Soviet citizenship. He'd left it blank. It had seemed false to call himself anything but Polish. How could he? The Soviet Union is, has always been, an enemy to his homeland. And besides, he'd spent every day of his life in Poland, had fought for Poland. He sure as hell wasn't going to give up his nationality just because a border had changed. Genick feels his body temperature rise as he realizes now that the questionnaire wasn't just a formality. It was a test of sorts, a way for the Soviets to weed out the prideful from the weak. By refusing citizenship, he'd labeled himself a resistor, someone who could be dangerous. Why else would they come for him? He locks his lips, refusing to admit there is truth in the officer's statement, and instead meets the man's eyes with a cold, stubborn stare.
And yet,
the officer continues, pressing his forefinger to the questionnaire,
you still say you are Polish.
I told you, I am from Poland. The veins in the officer's neck deepen in color to match the purple of the piping around his collar.
There is no such thing as Poland anymore, he bellows, a ball of spit torpedoing from his mouth.
A pair of young soldiers appears, and Genick recognizes them as two of the men who searched his flat. Genick glares at them, wondering if it was one of them who had stolen Herta's purse.
Thugs.
And then it's over. The officer dismisses them with a wag of his chin, and Genick and Herta are escorted out of the police quarters to the train station. It's dark inside the cattle car, and hot, the air swampy and reeking of human waste. There must be 36 bodies packed inside, but they can't tell for sure. It's hard to know. And they've lost track of how many have died. The prisoners sit shoulder to shoulder, their heads rocking back and forth in unison as the train clatters along on crooked rails. Genick closes his eyes, but it's impossible to sleep sitting up. And it'll be hours before it's his turn to stretch out. A man squats over a hole cut in the center of the car, and Herta gags. The stench is unbearable. It is July 23rd. They've been confined to the cattle car for 25 days. Genick has carved a small gash in the floor with his pocket knife for each day. On some, the train rolls straight through into the night, never slowing. On others, it stops and the doors are flung open to reveal a small station with a sign bearing an unrecognizable name. Every so often, a brave soul from a nearby village approaches the tracks, commiserating.
Poor people, where are they taking them?
Some come carrying a loaf of bread, a bottle of water, an apple. But the Russian guards are quick to shoo them away, swearing, their M-38s cocked. At most stops, a few of the train cars peel off, veering north or south. But Genick and Herta's car continues on its path. They haven't been told, of course, when or where they'll disembark. But they can tell by pressing their faces to the cracks in the train car's walls that they are headed east. When they first boarded the car in Lvov, Genick and Herta made a point of getting to know the others. All are Poles, Catholics and Jews alike. Most, like themselves, were sequestered in the middle of the night, their stories similar, arrested for refusing Soviet citizenship as Genick had, or for some made-up crime they had no way of proving they didn't commit. Some are alone, some with a brother or a wife by their side. There are several children on board. For a while, Genick and Herta found comfort in talking with the other prisoners, in sharing stories of the lives and families they'd left behind. It made them feel as if they weren't alone. Whatever was in store for them, it helped the prisoners to know they were in it together. But after a few days, they found they had little left to talk about. The chatter ceased and a funerary silence settle upon the train car, like ash over a dying fire. Some wept, but most slept, or simply sat quietly, withdrawing deeper into themselves, encumbered by the fear of the unknown, the reality that wherever they were being sent, it was far, far away from home. Genek's stomach rumbles as the train screams to a stop. He can't remember what it feels like to not be hungry. After a few minutes, a metal latch lifts, and the car's heavy door slides open, bathing the prisoners in daylight. They rub their eyes and squint at the outside world. Framed in the door, the landscape is bleak, flat, endless tundra, and in the distance, forest. They are the only humans in sight. No one rises. They know better than to try to climb from the train until they are given the order to do so. A guard in a starred cap climbs into the car, stepping over legs and between lice-ridden bodies. In the far corner he stops, bends down, and prods the shoulder of a prisoner propped against the wall with his chin resting on his chest. The old man is oblivious. The guard nudges him again, and this time the man's torso tips to the left, his forehead landing heavily on the shoulder of the woman next to him, who gasps. The guard seems annoyed.
"Stepan!"
he yells, and soon a comrade in a matching cap appears in the doorway.
"Another one!"
The new guard climbs aboard.
"Move!"
he barks, and the Poles in the corner scramble stiffly to their feet. Herta looks away as the Soviets bend to lift the limp body and shuffle toward the open door. Genek glances up as they pass by him, but the man's face is obscured. All he can see is an arm, dangling at an awkward angle, its skin a sickly yellow, the color of phlegm. At the doorway, the guards count to three, grunting as they heave the corpse from the train. Herta covers her ears, worried she might scream if she hears the sound of another dead body colliding with the ground. He's the third to be discarded this way in 3 days, tossed out like trash, left to rot beside the train tracks. For a while, she'd been able to tune it out, the hideousness of it. She'd let herself go numb. Sometimes, she pretended it was all a farce, something out of a horror film. And she'd let her mind float out of her physical body as she watched herself from above. Other times, her mind took her off the train entirely, conjuring up an image of an alternate universe, usually one salvaged from her past, from growing up in Bielsko, the opulent synagogue on Maya Street, with its ornate neo-Romanesque facade and its twin Moorish-style turrets, the view of the valley and of the beautiful Bielsko castle from atop Shinzelna Mountain, her favorite shady park, a couple of blocks from the Biala River, where she and her family would picnic when she was little. She would stay there as long as she could, comforted by the memories. But last week, when the baby died, a little girl no older than Genek's niece, she couldn't take it any longer. The child had starved. The mother's milk had gone dry. She didn't say anything for days, just sat in silence, her torso cocooned around the lifeless parcel in her arms. One afternoon, the guards noticed, and when they pulled the infant from her mother, the others erupted in shouts, "Please, it's unfair, let her be, please." But the guards turned their backs and threw the tiny body out of the train as they had the others, and the prisoner's pleas were soon drowned by the desperate howl of a woman whose heart had been severed in two. A woman who would refuse to eat, her grief too overpowering to withstand, and whose own lifeless body would be thrown from the train 4 days later. It was the soft thud of the infant's body meeting the earth that broke Herta, causing the numbness to give way to a hate that burned so deeply within, she wondered if her organs might catch fire. A third blue cap walks by with a bucket of water and a basket of bread, loaves the size of cigarette cartons, hard as bark. Genek takes one, breaks off a piece, hands the loaf to Herta. She shakes her head, too nauseated to eat. The door slides closed, and it's dark again inside the train car. Genek scratches at his scalp, and Herta reaches for his hand. "It'll only make it worse," she whispers. Genek slumps, unsure of what he's sickened by more. The fact that he's trapped in a world of inescapable decay, or the army of lice that has proliferated on his filthy scalp. He adjusts his suitcase beneath his bent knees and breathes through his mouth to avoid the appalling, fetid smell of death and rot. After a moment, there is a tap on his shoulder. The communal water tin has reached him. He sighs, dips his bread in the putrid water, and passes the tin to Herta. She takes a small sip and hands it to the body to her right. "It's disgusting," Herta whispers, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand. "It's all we've got. We'll die without it. Not the water. The rest of it. All of it." Genek reaches for Herta's hand. "I know. We just need to get off this train and then we'll manage. We'll be okay." In the darkness, he can feel Herta's eyes on him. "Will we?" A rush of guilt, now familiar, surges through him when Genek considers the fact that it is he who is responsible for their being here. Had he thought for a moment about the potential consequences of denying Soviet citizenship? Had he willingly checked the box on the questionnaire that fateful day? Things would be different. They would in all likelihood still be in Lvov. He rests his head against the wall of the train car behind him. It seemed so obvious at the time. It would have felt like a betrayal to give up his Polish citizenship. Herta swears that she wouldn't have declared allegiance to the Soviets either, that she'd have done the same had she been in his shoes. But oh, if he could only turn back time. "We will," Genek nods, swallowing his remorse. Wherever they are headed, it has to be better than the train. "We will," he repeats, wishing for some fresh air, some clarity. He closes his eyes, tormented by the sense of powerlessness that has settled inside him like a fistful of rocks since they boarded the train. He hates it. But what is there to do? His wit, his charm, his looks, the things he's relied upon all of his life to talk his way out of trouble? What good will they do him now? The one time he'd smiled at a guard, thinking he might win him over with niceties, the louse had threatened to punch in his pretty boy face. There has to be a way out. Genek's stomach turns, and he is struck suddenly by an impulse to pray. He's not a pious person, certainly hasn't spent much time in prayer, hasn't seen the point of it, really. But he's also not used to feeling so vulnerable. If there were ever a time to ask for help, he decides, it's now. It can't hurt. And so, Genek prays. He prays for their month-long exodus to reach its end, for a livable situation once they are allowed off the train, for his health and for Herta's, for his parents' safety, for his siblings' safety, especially his brother Adi's, whom he hasn't seen in well over a year. He prays for the day when he can be together again with his family. If the war is over soon, he fantasizes, perhaps he'll see them in October for Rosh Hashanah. How sweet it would be to start the Jewish New Year together. Genek silently repeats his pleas over and over again until someone in the car begins to sing an anthem. Boże coś Polską. God save Poland. Others join, and the singing grows louder. As the words reverberate through the dark, dank car, Genek sings along quietly. Please, God, protect Poland. Protect us. Protect our families. Please.
November 1939 to June 1941. Over 1 million Polish men, women, and children are deported by the Red Army to Siberia, Kazakhstan, and Soviet Asia, where they face hard physical labor, squalid living conditions, harsh climate extremes, disease, and starvation. They die by the thousands. September 7, 1940. The London Blitz. For 57 consecutive nights, German planes drop bombs on the British capital. The Luftwaffe's aerial attacks extend to 15 other British cities over 37 weeks. Refusing to capitulate, Churchill orders the Royal Air Force to maintain a relentless counterattack. September 27, 1940. Germany, Italy, and Japan signed the Tripartite Pact, forming an Axis alliance. October 3, 1940. The Vichy government of France issues a law, the Statut des Juifs, abolishing the civil rights of Jews living in France.
Chapter 13. Addie. Vichy France, December 1940. Addie paces along the sidewalk before the stepped entranceway of the Hôtel du Parc. It's not yet 8 in the morning, but he is charged. Every fiber of his body alive with nervous energy. He should have eaten something, he realizes, shaking off the cold as he walks. It has already begun to feel like one of the coldest winters ever in France. A suited man with close-cropped blonde hair emerges from the hotel, and Addie pauses for a moment, recalling the most recent photo of Sosa Dantas he'd seen in the paper. Not him. Luis Martins de Sosa Dantas, Brazil's ambassador to France, is dark-haired with broad features. He's heavier set. Addie has spent the past month learning everything he can about him. From what he's gleaned, the ambassador is a popular man. He is especially adored in Paris, where his name carries somewhat of a celebrity status in the city's elite social and political circles. Sosa Dantas was relocated from Paris to Vichy when France fell to Germany in June. He and a handful of other ambassadors from Axis-friendly powers, the Soviet Union, Italy, Japan, Hungary, Romania, Slovakia. His new office is on the Boulevard des États-Unis, but Addie has heard rumors that he sleeps at the Hôtel du Parc and that he's been quietly and illegally issuing Jews visas to Brazil. Addie checks his watch. It's almost 8. The embassy will open soon. He exhales through the corners of his mouth as he contemplates the consequence of his plan not working. What then? As much as it pains him to admit it, returning to Poland is out of the question. With France in the hands of the Nazis, not only is a transit visa impossible to acquire, the idea of staying put seems impossible too. There is no safe future for him in Axis-controlled Europe. Addie had thought twice about applying for a Brazilian visa, as Brazil's quasi-fascist dictator, Getúlio Vargas, was said to be sympathetic to the Nazi regime. But he had already been denied visas to Venezuela, to Argentina, and, after waiting for 2 days in a line that stretched around the American embassy's block, to the United States. He is running out of options. Of course, fleeing to Brazil would mean putting the distance of an ocean between Addie and his family, the thought of which torments him to no end. It's been 13 months since he last heard from his mother in Radom. He wonders often if any of his letters have reached her, if she would feel hurt or betrayed to learn of his plan to leave Europe. No, of course not, he assures himself. His mother would want him to get out while he can, and anyway, he will be no less reachable in Brazil than he has been for the past several months in France. Still, to leave without the peace of mind of knowing that his parents and siblings are safe, without their knowing of his plan or how to contact him, feels wrong. To quiet his conscience, Addie reminds himself that if he's able to secure a visa, and thanks to it, a more permanent address, he can put all of his energy into tracking down the family once he's settled somewhere safe.
if only procuring a Brazilian visa were an easier task. His first attempt was a failure. He'd waited at the Brazilian embassy for 10